try to articulate their initial question as clearly and as they possibly can, and then we can have some supplemental discussion as we follow on. So I will start with Professor Mizak.
Okay, so I'm supposed to ask a question.
Yes, you're supposed to. You are the student.
Okay, I really enjoyed last night. I thought it was a fantastic evening, and I learned a lot. And I guess I would like to raise the issue of the human dimension in all this. It was touched on nicely by our historian. And we had in Canada a global change program associated with our academy, the Royal Society, and it was a very successful program. And it was successful because we brought together members of the academy from the humanities and social sciences with natural sciences. And I was hoping to hear a little bit more about the human behavior aspects of the reasons why we're creating the planet we are, and whether we shouldn't be putting more energy into behavioral activities. So I guess my question is directed to anyone, but especially maybe to start with our historian.
Sure. Should I use this? Yeah, thanks. Well, I think what I tried to point out last night was the crying need for that kind of work. And the some people would argue, some people do argue, that the global change science has been, in a way, fully populated and in another way dominated by climate modeling or physical Earth system modeling. And the human dimensions have been there, but they haven't been very dominant. They've sort of been the poor cousin of the physical sciences. So there's an asymmetry, and there's a great opportunity as well as a great need there. Another colleague of mine argues that that even within the social sciences, certainly the economists have been out of the gate quickly. If this is a race to save planet Earth, I think the economists are out fast as well, but some of the humanists haven't even gone to the gates and got their horses mounted yet. So I think there's an opportunity there. There is an asymmetry there. And I'm not an expert in cross-cutting human behavior, but I think history gives you a nice a bit of perspective, if you will. That most people live in their own personal memory cones. We touch upon other memory cones of people like our family members, grandparents, older professors, older colleagues. So we're able to extend our human experiences back into the early 20th century by talking with other people who have actually been there, done that. But there's a third kind of thing, which is the formal study of history, which allows us access to all of human experience in some ways, I mean, to at least a slice through human experience. And I think we need that bigger slice. We simply cannot go forward with our own just personal memories and perspectives and reacting in a way to modern events. But we should be thinking about what does antiquity tell us, or what did people know about human behavior through myth and tradition and other ways of knowing. And I think that those ways of knowing, as I think it was Gro Harlem Brundtland said at in the UN Commission back in the 70s, she said, current environmental challenges require all of our skills. And I would underline all.
Do any of the other panelists want to respond to this, or Phil?
Since Jim mentioned economics, is that part of your question?
No, human behaviors.
Human behaviors.
Yes. Conservation and change of lifestyles, that sort of thing.
So you're talking about how people might respond to climate change?
Or how might we mitigate climate change?
Certainly, people aren't going to change their behaviors unless they're forced to do it. And people like to be comfortable in the way that they have grown up and heated their homes and driven their cars and things like that. And they don't want to be inconvenienced to deal with something that they can't experience. I mean, so the global climate's gone up by half a degree less than a degree in the past century. What does that mean to me? I mean, weather changes because it's warm. The wind direction is different. It's warm and cold on different days. And I get reporters calling me, it's really warm this December. Is that global warming? Or it's really cold this winter. Where'd global warming go? And so people don't understand that the first word is global, and it's an average, and it's a statistical thing based on the oscillation of the weather is inside of this. It's hard for people to experience it, and it's hard for people to think about long time scales, because if you change your behavior tomorrow, the climate's not going to change. It's accumulated over decades, and it's something that's important for your children and grandchildren. That makes it a very difficult. Furthermore, CO2 is invisible, and you can't smell it. If cars had charcoal briquettes coming out of the back and they started piling up, maybe people might do something about it. If you close down a dirty smokestack from a factory, all of a sudden the air is clean. You can see it. But if you stop CO2 emissions, you can't see it. So it's a different scale than normal human experience, and that makes it very difficult for people to respond to it.
Bill?
Well, I'd like to respond from a point of view that's more geoengineering-centric, in a sense, and just say that also there have been conversations over the last year or two that acknowledge that mostly between scientists, but occasionally we've tried to incorporate conversations with others from the more human dimensions side of research and thought to consult with those communities about ways of making decisions about geoengineering itself, and also following along the lines of the conversation that Jim Fleming and I had last night about, and certainly that Alan presented as well, under what circumstances is it appropriate to consider research into geoengineering, and how does one make it transition from the very theoretical explorations that we're currently doing through experimental, very small-scale experiments to experiments that might actually have any influence on the Earth's climate. And furthermore, there are some other aspects of the problem as well to just bring to the table, and that's to also note that on the other component of geoengineering, which we've not discussed at the workshop, at the symposium here, but that is of mechanisms for attempting to draw down the concentrations of CO2, there have been some activities that have begun to come closer to real-world implementations, and I'm thinking particularly of ocean fertilization experiments in order to draw down CO2. And what we've seen in the context of those experiences are that the public perception of the of those experiments was quite negative, actually, and with all sort of motives assigned to the people who were doing those ocean fertilization experiments, in spite of the fact that prior to any discussion of using it as a mechanism for drawing down CO2, that there were some quite interesting scientific studies that were done to look at how these nutrients might influence ocean ecosystems. So I'm bringing this up because there are some scientists among us who are also concerned about how one presents the issues associated with geoengineering to the public, how we engage in a conversation between various communities in the human array, and how we make decisions about how to move forward on this.
Okay. It's perfectly legitimate for other discussants also to engage in the conversation too. But since Alan raised it, the question about, and Jim said that the economists were the first out of the gate, or very close to first out of the gate, it's appropriate that we hear from Chris Green.
But not on that subject. Last night, two of the panelists implied that the technologies existed capable of stabilizing climate. Now, let me just state my own view, and then I'll ask the question. I don't think that statement is remotely true. If you measure the technology challenge correctly, and if by existed you mean that something like the current state of those technologies could do the job, we're not even remotely close to having the technologies to do the job. I realize this is a very, very controversial view, but what I would like to ask each of the panelists is the following. Suppose I'm right, that it's going to take a technology revolution over the course of this century if we want to have any hope of stabilizing climate, with many breakthroughs, not only in new technologies, but in reducing the cost of existing ones and creating enabling technologies that will be required to even use or scale up current technologies. Supposing I'm right that this technology breakthrough, technology revolution is needed, would that change any of your views as stated last night about geoengineering?
I can respond slightly. Well, the first thing to say is that I was not, I hope, among the two who stated that the technology existed.
One of them is missing, and it's unfortunate.
That was what
I would. I wish he was here because I really am aiming it at him.
Certainly.
But the person on my left also made the statement. So
that's easy to pick on.
So either way, there are two. So one person.
Well, the other component of my
which
response.
I don't remember saying that, but anyway.
Well, let me just finish, which was just to say that I don't personally feel that I have the expertise to respond directly to your question, and it's too bad David Keith is not available to do it. What I will say, though, is one of the things which has been discussed as one way of looking at geoengineering in particular is to use it as a mechanism for buying us a bit of time to make a transition to a different energy technology. So even if we don't have the technology today, then it's worthwhile considering the consequences of geoengineering as this mechanism.
So did you think I said we have the technology to do mitigation or to do geoengineering?
No, I said the technology's you said the technology's existed to greatly reduce emissions or stabilize climate. I don't remember what it was.
For mitigation, not for...
For mitigation.
Okay.
For mitigation. And
okay.
I'm only talking about mitigation.
I just wanted to clarify what you said.
By the way, just so you understand that I tend to share the concerns of those who would be very wary about using geoengineering. So, or SF, solar radiation management, because other types were suggested, such as cloud whitening, and that may be a lot less... involved. But in any event.
Okay, so first of all, I don't think you're correct, but if you want me to assume that you are correct, then
he's an economist. You can make an assumption.
I used to have my license plate used to say 4CASTR, and a guy at a gas station said to me, so are you a meteorologist or an economist? And I said, well, clearly I'm a meteorologist because they can't forecast. So anyway, certainly the technology to do geoengineering doesn't exist. So certainly that doesn't exist. If we wanted to do it, we couldn't possibly do it. We need to do research to see if it's even possible. So if you're right and it doesn't exist, we're screwed. That we can't do mitigation and can't do geoengineering. So, but I don't agree with you saying that we can't do mitigation. I personally have done it, and people in Europe use half the amount of energy per person than people here in Canada and the U.S. and live the same lifestyle. So there's all kinds of ways. I don't know why we have all these lights on here. There's a skylight, but I know they have a couple for the TV, but we waste energy. The buildings are too hot here. And we could use energy much more efficiently, and that technology certainly exists. I put solar panels on my roof. I generate most of my electricity with solar now, and I live in New Jersey where there isn't that much sun. There's all kinds of ways, if we increase the price of carbon, that we can use existing technologies and people will invent new technologies. And so I don't think saying that we can't do it, period, is a way of moving forward. I think we need to try to do it, and we need to take the control away from the institutions that are preventing us from doing it.
I didn't say...
Okay, Chris, you have to respond in the mic.
You
use the mic.
I did not say you couldn't do some mitigation. That was not the question. The question is whether you can stabilize climate with the existing technologies.
Well, it depends what you mean by stabilize climate. If you want to keep temperature from rising from what it is today with current technologies, no, we can't. I agree with that. Depends how much warmer you want to let it get. If you want to keep it a degree warmer, we can do that. If you want to keep it from, so there will be a certain amount of warming built into the system right now. The CO2 that we put in stays there for a long time, a certain fraction of it. So, but we have the technology, and we're using our resources and our clever people doing other things. Half of the scientists and engineers in the U.S. work for the military. What if we put them to work on something to help the planet? I mean, the whole system is so skewed that I think it's easy to look at a future where if we worked really hard at it, we could do mitigation.
Do you have anything to say, Jim? Or
I'll pass an interesting
question. All right. Okay, so we'll move on to John Geichel.
So last evening, as a result of the discussion last evening, I think Alan mentioned there was a statement by the American Meteorological Society on geoengineering. And among the three recommendations include enhanced research on the scientific and technological potential for geoengineering the climate system. Number two, a coordinated study of historical, ethical, legal, and social implications of geoengineering. Number three, development and analysis of policy options to promote transparency and international cooperation in exploring geoengineering options. So all of these recommendations actually involve the utilization of resources, namely funding. And I'm just wondering what the panelists feel about the potential diversion of relatively scarce resources from scientific research and understanding type research into climate models and regional climate models into what some people might regard as a rather ludicrous enterprise that involves several hundreds of millions of dollars of research.
I'll answer. I think if you think it's a fixed sum game and you're going to take resources away from more useful things and put them into this, that is a moral hazard. That would be a mistake. But if we add additional money and do it in addition to other things that we're doing, not only would we be able to figure out whether it's even possible or safe, we would also develop technologies that can be used for lots of other things. I have a grant to study geoengineering right now, but I'm also studying volcanic eruptions. We're using the same climate model, and we're looking at the recent ones. We feel like that's part of understanding an analog to geoengineering. In the nuclear winter days, research on nuclear winter had forced us to put aerosols into our climate models. They hadn't really had them before, and those codes that could transport aerosols and look at their effects have been very useful for all kinds of other studies of climate change. So it's not either or. In the U.S., Obama put more money increase in science research into the stimulus bill than had ever been done in the history of our country. He gave NSF, National Science Foundation, $3 billion, a one-time shot. The NSF budget has been increased now $200 million per year into the future in climate research. And so if a little bit of that is used to figure out whether this works or not, and we learn other things along the way, if we put a observing system to look at stratospheric aerosols, which we need anyway because we are not prepared for the next volcanic eruption. I think it can be done. Everybody can win from doing it, and I don't think it's as black and white as taking people from doing useful things and doing something that might not work.
If I could just follow up to it, it's to say I think Alan's made most of the points, and as far as I know, the people who are making suggestions that one might consider some explicit funding for geoengineering are doing so with two assumptions built into it. One of them is that it would be a very, very small fraction of the total research dollars that are going towards understanding climate science. Even a small amount of money would make a real difference here. As far as I know, in the U.S., Alan has identified one explicit grant that he and his group manage associated with geoengineering. I think there might be one that's funded from NASA. To my knowledge, there are no others. When I was working at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, I was able to utilize some of my own resources with sort of the de facto approval of my institutional superiors and the freedom, the academic freedom to do research that I wanted, but there, but I felt blessed to be able to do that. I think that there is no explicit money for geoengineering research around, and I know from very explicit, specific conversations with funding managers in the U.S. that they're extremely cautious about, you know, and view it as a very dangerous thing to discuss or to fund research without some perception of support from either policymakers at higher levels or the public at large. And so part of the AMS policy, from my point of view, is making the discussion explicit and allowing for conversations to take place and specific decisions to be made rather than to force us all to be doing this one person at a time.
I just wanted to follow up, actually. Well, these are quite excellent answers, but they're focused more on North America, and I'm just wondering to what extent this same type of responsible behavior would be repeated in other countries of the world among the learned societies and funding agencies.
I'm sort of backing up to the original question, too, but I was on that panel with Alan and some others, and I remember fighting really hard to keep the second point in. That's the historical, ethical, legal, social dimensions that are intended to be international and intercomparative and intergenerational. And if you doubled our budget, we wouldn't even go from $1 to $2. That would be 100.
Zero.
Yeah, two times zero is zero. So we had nothing. But we felt it was crucial and even urgent. And I've been circulating a little document I found. I just spoke about Harry Wexler about 2 hours ago, who was the head of research in 62 in the Weather Bureau. And he's AMS generated a statement on weather and climate control in 62. And it has the first point and the third point. It has the point about open and collaborative research. And this was the Kennedy administration's push to have a peaceful use of outer space and peaceful use of any new technologies that came up, maybe bilateral, especially in that era. And it also had the point about it had the first and the third points, but it didn't have the second point at all. And so I really had to fight over the course of that committee meeting to keep putting it back in. Different drafts came by, maybe 10 or 15 drafts. And I remember the middle part kept getting a little bit savaged and a little bit shortened, and I kept expanding it each time and putting it back in so that by the 15th iteration it remained. So I was kind of proud of that one, and it's not going to cost anything. I guess that's all I need to say.
If I could just respond one more time. With respect to your question about whether there is any activities on the international front on this, and I will say that I have been sitting on international committees in various forms and know that this is now being geoengineering issues are now being discussed explicitly among learned societies at the international level. For example, the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, of which I've been a member, has assigned a specific task for study to a few individuals at this point in the game, so it's come onto their radar, and I think the conversations like this are ways of trying to promote the putting it on the radar as much as trying to get geoengineering research actually being done. I think that these kind of conversations of getting it as part of the dialogue and conversation is also important.
I'm going to a meeting in Hamburg, Germany next week, along with David Keith. They have a 1 million euro project to do geoengineering research among several different climate modeling groups in Europe, and they're having this meeting. Dave is going on to Heidelberg, where he said they have another 1 million euros to study more social aspects of it. And so people find it interesting, and there's what?
I need 2 bucks.
You need 2 bucks. And they're find it interesting, and they're spending some time putting some resources into it, but there is no international program yet. One of the questions is, are my climate model results robust? The review paper. We already published a review paper last year on this. Phil was the first author. And we compared our two climate model results, and we got different results for precipitation, but we did different experiments. And so I'm organizing all the climate modelers in the world to do the same standard geoengineering experiments as part of the suite of simulations they're doing for the next IPCC report, so that we can compare them and see, do they get exact? Is this result robust or not? Is it something we should be concerned about? And so there's the whole rest of the world that doesn't have this climate modeling infrastructure. I've talked about Europe and North America. There's a few modelers in other places in the world, but what about people that are be impacted? There, I don't know of any way that's organized talking to people who will be affected and people that really don't have the resources and power to get involved. So that's probably something that still hasn't been done. But the third part of the AMS recommendation was that it be an international program and that it be open and that everybody, we don't even have the governance now either to decide whether we could test in the atmosphere or whether we could implement it. So it has to be done internationally. But you can't forget that we know about this, and so we really have to know whether it's a crazy idea or not.
I'll check the chair's prerogative here right now and just point out that in this most recent report from the Royal Society, which is the last recommendation in it, is that the relevant UK government departments in association with the Research Council should together fund a 10-year program of research on geoengineering and associated climate change science focused on addressing the priorities identified in Box 5.1, and they recommend that should have £11 million per annum should go into it. Now, that's a typical statement that you get out of a lot of research reports, or reports that say, of course, give us some money. But it's interesting, if you do go to the Box 5.1, which talks about the research priorities, there are about 15 listed, and one or two are actually directly related to the management of incoming solar radiation. Almost all the research priorities that are identified down here relate to the governance, economic, social aspects of, and ethical issues related to this. And then on the actual mechanisms themselves, there is an extremely heavy concentration on carbon removal mechanisms as opposed to the solar radiation initiatives. So there is the call for research dollars specifically, but it's...
Can I follow?
Yep, and then Morris.
So it's certainly true that there's a bit of a increase in funding in scientific research in the United States, but for example, in the UK, might it not be the case that some of these research dollars have been in fact diverted from perhaps useful projects that would be designed to improve regional climate modeling, improvement of parameterizations of cloud processes, cumulus convection, critical processes that are key to understanding how the regions are impacted by climate change? Other countries don't necessarily have these stimulus packages.
I just want to make a comment and give information for the future. In Melbourne in 2011 will be the next International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics meeting. This is a meeting held every 4 years of international geosciences, including atmosphere, ocean, cryospheric sciences, and so on. And we will be having a so-called union symposium on geoengineering. So I invite the panelists to participate heavily in that conference. Because IUGG is a non-government organization, number one. And number two, it is truly international, unlike, say, the American Geophysical, American Meteorological Society. It's a true international organization, and which has as much as we can bring together people from countries all around the world. It works very hard at this. So I think that will be a very useful forum for you all to attend and participate.
Okay. Oh, sorry, are you going
to... Well, I was just going to respond one last time to John, which is just to say I think that the with respect to your concerns about diverting money from other very useful things, certainly from my point of view is, with respect to solar radiation management, it should presumably be quite a small fraction of the... what I'll say is a very small fraction of the current budget would make a very big difference to the amount of geoengineering research that could be done today. And secondly, that I'm quite content to allow it to be prioritized along with all of the other useful research that you might one might identify as climate change research as well. And I'm not going. I would not make the point that it is, for example, more important than research dollars being put into a refinement of a convection parameterization. Although I think that then one might ask whether the funding managers might say, well, I'll give N dollars to convective parameterization research and N over 10 to geoengineering research. You know.
Can I just say with respect to convection research, we've been trying it for decades and still haven't figured out how to do it, so that money may have all been wasted. And so I remember Rick Anthes said a couple years ago, what we've learned from convection research is that it can't be done. So we can't parameterize it. We have to explicitly model the clouds. And so that would cost a lot more money. But I don't think it's I don't think it's as black and white as you take it out of one pot and put it in another pot. The whole pot has to grow. Climate is important. Most governments of the world realize it. And the total amount of resources our whole community uses compared to what the planet uses is so tiny that adding a little bit for geoengineering isn't going to hurt anything.
It was not my intention to focus exclusively on convective parameterizations. However, it is the case that as technology grows and the climate models have a lot more grid points, there's a much greater need to understand the essential physics. That was my only point. And there's a lot of work that really does need to be done, particularly with respect to these cloud processes. Also with respect to the whole issue of whether the results are robust or not. So I just want to make sure that adequate funding is still made available for really understanding the natural world.
I would put a question to the panel, which I don't expect them to answer because I know what the answer is, but I would think everyone across the panel would agree that the funding in all these areas is totally inadequate. And I would think most of the people that are in the room would argue that their funds are inadequate. So we're always in a scarce resource situation. Patrick.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank the panelists. I enjoyed their presentations very much. So how many engineers are there in the audience? Just out of curiosity. Two engineers. I know Lauren was one. So it's an interesting sideline here because now I had to explain to my colleagues in actual geoengineering, what the hell is going on in terms of the climate people tagging on to this?
I got that journal sent to me in the mail the other day.
Okay, so so I think probably maybe you know if whether this is trying to get respectability to the science, I don't know, but I think I'll leave it to the experts to decide on that. But certainly engineering, the term engineering carries with it a lot of responsibility. And I don't think it's just tinkering. You need to be able to find right solutions to these problems and then right models. Just to give an example, a friend of mine asked me, oh, so you're a big computational fluid dynamics modeler, you know surface science, you know geosciences, chemistry, etc. Can you predict for me which way a particle of fluid will trickle down the windscreen? I had to sort of step back for a moment and I said, look, I really don't know. It depends on whether the car is stationary or whether the car is actually moving. And the only thing I can say is that it either goes sideways or goes down. So there are a lot of issues related to modeling that, you know, if you're going to if you're going to develop scenarios where actually you're going to use some sort of engineering process, then the issue of what is the control area that you're going to look at and who controls this. It's a pity that David Keith isn't here because I would have put the question to him. He posed the problem in such a way that this is a boundary value problem. It's where are these boundaries? Who controls these boundaries? What comes into the boundaries and what goes out of the boundaries? Without a knowledge of these things and be able to have some sort of a predictive capability, it would mean that people will the public will have the perception that this is just tinkering. And tinkering means that, you know, something could go wrong, something could go right, and you'll never be able to specifically sell an idea that this is a viable one. And the other side of the coin is really that there are ways of mitigation that really should be exhaustively studied. These are at our disposal, and the people who are really involved in superficial disposal have ideas. They need to be tested as well. They are not foolproof. David Keith also mentioned nuclear waste disposal. Nuclear waste, unfortunately, has a half-life. So 10,000 years is the target life for the disposal. How long have you got to sequester carbon dioxide in the ground? Perpetually? No. So basically, those are questions that need to be examined. So it's not a cut-and-dry case in these situations, but I think the panel should address these issues squarely if they want to, first of all, attach the word engineering to it, because that means you have a solution that works. It may not be the perfect solution, but it's a solution that works.
My grant from National Science Foundation comes partly from the Engineering Directorate, and they have a sustainability part of that, and they want to look at ethical aspects of engineering. And so Martin Bunzel, a philosopher at Rutgers, is on the grant with me looking at ethical aspects funded by the engineers. When David said boundary value problem, what he meant was that weather is random chaotic variation of the winds and clouds and things, and we can't predict it beyond a couple weeks. But a boundary value problem, what he meant is the average amount of energy coming in and out of the system changes gradually because of greenhouse gases or because of particles in the stratosphere. And so within that, we're not predicting what it's going to be on a specific day, but some statistics of the mean temperature or things like that. That's what he meant by that. And that's how we understand climate system anyway, even without geoengineering. That's just what, that was just the answer to how can you predict climate without predicting the weather.
I have a section in my book that tries to look at what people have defined the macro scale geoengineering to be. Mm. And the word simply doesn't exist in the Oxford English Dictionary. Mm. Engineering could be either civil or military, and it is well defined, as you said. The linguistic confusion is really quite vast in this area. And so in trying to bring some clarity to it, I went to other sources. One was the new Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year. And I think it was in 2007, the Word of the Year was hypermiling. This is sort of coasting to save gas because the price spike. But one of the runners-up was eco-hacking. And the definition of eco-hacking was very close to geoengineering. Go Google eco-hacking and you'll find a whole set of definitions like that.
If you look at today's independent newspaper from London, one of the main headlines is eco-hacking and the whole article is on geoengineering.
It's making its way into our lexicon. But I wanted to say that with the historical, social, ethical, legal thing that I've keep coming back to, I'm really quite much more interested in large-scale issues that cut across things that bring together genetic engineering with nanotechnology engineering. And for me, the STS approach, or the as I was telling Patrick earlier, my first STS course was taught by an engineer who took human dimensions of technical activity very seriously.
Tell us what STS is.
Yes, what's STS?
Space Transportation System, the shuttle. No. STS has about 20 different definitions, science. Too. But in the U.S., it means science and technology studies. It's known as science studies in the U.K. But the engineers got a conscience in the 70s, and they began to continue to teach the social side of things, or they, at least they codified this into a new program. I got a little reaction about got a conscience, but they codified it in the Vietnam era to pull together the ethical effects of what they were working on. And this new field came out. So for me, geoengineering is one of the exemplars of macro-scale human tinkering with the environment. It brings together a lot of interests that other people have about GMOs and about waste disposal, maybe hydrological issues. But this seems to be the geo makes it the planetary scale and puts an umbrella over our sort of community that's interested in the technological fix. We have a book of essays we did called The Tech Fix. And there seems to be a characteristic human propensity to go look for, to fix something with something else. And Edward Teller, who's trained a lot of the current crop of geoengineer speculators, thought that, for example, things like H-bombs were a technological fix for A-bombs. And city sprawl, urban sprawl, was a technological fix for possible atomic attacks on cities. And so this is where the tradition comes from, and so we're sort of into not simply geoengineering studies, but we're looking at the whole suite of surrounding attitudes towards nature and towards intervention.
I think the point I was trying to make is really that if the intention is to provide specific solutions that work, that are guaranteed. Nothing is 100% safe, but if the intention is to provide solutions that work, then the responsibility is a lot greater than just saying, well, it might work or it might not work.
Well, my reaction to your comments are essentially that you're right on the money. And this is you've used your own words to express the concerns that those of us who are interested in working in this area have also. We do recognize the responsibility of coming up with a solution that works, and none of us are advocating that we have such a solution or indicating that we have, or even that we know what the right direction to go is. What we've come up with are looked at a spectrum of hypothesized solutions, picked a few that we think are more easily studied and potentially viable, and done the first baby steps of exploring those, indicating that we don't know whether they will work or not work. And with respect to your concerns about the word geoengineering, I will say that the field is not that new, although as Jim and David and Alan have all mentioned, it goes back, the ideas of changing the climate go back a long ways, certainly decades. And throughout those decades, occasionally we agonize over what the right name for this field is. And sometimes people discuss climate intervention, and sometimes geoengineering, and there have been other names bandied about as well. We use geoengineering because it seems to be the one that's been adopted most frequently in the community.
Let me just say one thing about CO2 sequestration. It doesn't have to be perfect like nuclear waste. A little bit can leak out slowly, and it's not going to be a big deal. It's not poisonous, toxic, so unless it's very highly concentrated, like Lake Nyos. But there are no institutions that can monitor it and keep it there for 100 years, and insurance, and who's responsible, and even tracking where it goes if Granny Smith's farm, her pond behind her house turns into Perrier, 10 years later. Who's responsible? So those are all issues. But while we're at it, we should fix the word greenhouse effect. That's not how it works either. It's not really a greenhouse. So sometimes we're stuck with jargon that's not really the right name, but it's a convenient word, and it's kind of hard to get rid of it.
This magazine landed on my desk this morning. In fact, there's a Scottish agency for CCS now, carbon capture and storage. So everybody is keen on the mitigation side of it. It's not going to go away. I don't think there's going to be any single solution that's going to be applicable for every situation. You need to be able to look at alternative methods and then basically cutting down. You mentioned about the lights being on. Yes. This is really the thin end of the wedge, basically. So
you save money doing those things.
And so I would say that there's no one magic bullet. You need to be able to approach this on several fronts.
In some countries have already outlawed these light bulbs here, mm-hmm. these incandescent light bulbs. Mm-hmm.
The discussion almost exclusively has been, over the last 24 hours, has been related to solar radiation management, yet the one of the other halves of geoengineering that people refer to is the carbon dioxide removal, which, and I understand from casual conversations with the panelists that many of you put that in the same category as the mitigation side of things. You were talking about this last night, Alan, when somebody asked you specifically about, actually I believe it was Lauren, asked you the question about what your views were on carbon dioxide removal.
It's such a completely different, sometimes it's labeled geoengineering, but it's a completely different topic. Taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that's causing the warming is probably a really good thing if we can do it safely and cheaply enough. It can be done. It's already being done today. The technology exists. It's just quite expensive. And to do it on a very large scale, it hasn't been developed yet. But that's sort of, it's hard to think of bad things about removing CO2 unless, as some global warming deniers say, oh, it fertilizes plants. It's really good to have more CO2. But probably taking it out, it's. I think we should focus more on not putting it in the first place.
Exactly.
That's a lot cheaper.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's where I wanted to start the discussion. I think it's all human behavior gets back to what do we want, what do we need, and how much do we need. And we're excessively pampered today.
Okay. So I would like to open it up to the floor now and invite people to question. You can direct your questions in general to the panel or to specific people on the panel, and we just do not have to have our three guests from outside on the hot seat. Feel free to ask everybody else. So I will start with Renee in the very back. She had her hand up, and then we'll go to the second question here.
Nothing motivates people like desire or terror, and a good deal of that is irrational. So irrational desire, which I'd include the technological fix in, and irrational terror, and which leads me to ask the question, there are a lot of conspiracy theories about climate change not happening, but why has there never been a conspiracy theory in favor of climate change? Because they're always, and that could employ that of the irrational terror part, so the climate change as a phenomenon employs many of the characteristics that are highly suitable for a conspiracy theory, right? It's this single narrative of how it happens, and you can tie all these things together, and you have to move people around a lot. So if we were to really talk about employing human behavior and learning from history on how to mobilize action, we might want to look to those sorts of things and not this hyper-rational approach to in this technocratic policy making to kind of solve this problem.
Are you saying we need to demonize it? It has to be the enemy so that we can all gather together to fight against it?
No, we need to say that climate change is like 2012.
Alan's lost. He doesn't know what 2012 is.
There are so many things about the science of climate change that to which we could attach conspiracy theory to, so we could say, you know, the world is ending, and there are all these secret plots to increase temperature. And
the problem is, everybody's doing it together. You know, everybody's contributing. It's not one agent that's doing it. It's what you drove your car here, you turn your lights on, you cook your food, so you're part of the problem. Everybody says, don't tell me I'm part of the problem. I don't want to have to change my life. So you can't tell everybody they're part of the conspiracy. I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean by how you would frame that.
Chris, you wanted to... Well, Chris.
No, go ahead. You speak, because I'm not sure, Chris. Okay, I'm not exactly sure what you're driving at, but let's look at this rationally. The world uses energy, and 85% of that energy is carbon emitting. So I don't think there's any conspiracy that we've used energy, and that these fuels that at one time were thought to be the basis of a good modern life and so on are putting emissions in the air, and they're changing the energy balance of the Earth. That this is just a matter of physics. How much it will change is another thing. Now, the question is, what are the things that drive those emissions? Population growth. I don't know that there's a big conspiracy about that population is increasing. Growth in output per capita. Well, people want to be better off. I don't see any conspiracy there. The energy intensity of the activities that are taking on, which depend on energy efficiency and the type of activities. And, of course, back to the basic thing, and that is the degree to which we have alternative low-carbon technologies. I would submit to you that they are very limited in terms of their scalability at present. We need a technological revolution to change that. That's what I was getting at before. It can be done, but you have to focus on that. So it seems to me that this is not a matter of conspiracy, and if I can point to just one thing, take a look at the country of China. In 1978, 80% of the people of China were in rural areas, and they were kept there by the Hukou system, which required a permit to live in the cities. Since 1978, China has undergone a revolution in terms of its capabilities of producing goods and services, and increasingly they have allowed people to move into cities, so that 20% is now 42%. Now, with populations, and China may have the same amount of land as the U.S., but keep in mind that much of it's desert, much of it's mountains. So what you have is this huge population in limited areas beginning to move into concentrated ones, and even rural areas have become cities. There's so many million-plus cities, and many of them didn't exist before. And whenever you start housing those people, you have to build up. And once you get beyond three or four stories, you're using cement, steel, flat glass, copper, aluminum. And the energy intensity of those materials is an order of magnitude or more higher than other types of manufactured goods. Result? The world needs energy just so people who want to live a little better live in cities. We say people should live in cities, not just be commuting. If you're in big buildings, you can't have little alleys with just no pavement. You have to have broad pavements. You have to have underpasses. You have to have overpasses. You have to have subways that work in the city. You have to have, with 100 or more now, million person or more cities in China, you have to have ways to move between them. Much of it is not just roads. It's railroads, airports, and so on and so forth. Think of the materials that go into that. There is where you have enormous energy. There is no conspiracy. It's rising expectations of people who want a little better life than they had before.
You're missing the point, Chris. The point is that we try very rational approaches to try and get people to do something about climate change. And people tend to be very irrational. And I'm wondering whether or not we can exploit conspiracy theories.
Are you suggesting we introduce an irrational approach?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you want to respond, Jim? Or
I'll just say there is something more to life than the purely rational calculus. And just emotionally, I had an emotional reaction when we were down at Capitol Hill and talking about Nebraska beef. And three of us went over to the Capitol for that new visitor center for some lunch, and we all ended up with a vegetarian lunch. And we started talking about what if we had sort of, instead of Catholic meatless Fridays, we had Thursday meatless green days or something, you know. And so it was an emotional reaction. And my reaction to getting on too many jets recently has been to try to plant more trees and things like that. So there's an evocative emotional side to things. And people have they've talked in a negative way about conspiracy theories, like the popular novel by Michael Crichton. It was full of conspiracy theories about bad greenies trying to force the global warming agenda on other people, you know. And so there are currents like that out there, whether they're being exploited or not, or whether you could have a trigger mechanism to exploit fear and irrationality. you know, there are people on the far right that would say that there's a conspiracy towards forcing things towards a world government and taking away national sovereignties. And so that there are things other than infrared radiative transfer and shortwave radiation going on in this thing. And one of the guys at the Tyndall Center once told me that CO2 was the environmental molecule of choice, that everything comes and goes through the CO2 molecule. And so our whole understanding, it's almost like a climatic determinist reductionist move in which, we sort of were fixated on U-235 back in the 40s, and we were fixated on the double helix in the 60s, and still are, but we have a way of taking a molecular move and sort of moving our whole culture, our whole energy, our whole climate, our whole behavior around a single molecular reference point, I guess I'll call it that. So I don't know if that's rational or not either.
Okay. Just want, for people that are asking questions, make sure you turn your mic on because it is being taped. So you need to turn it on. Renee knew that because she's a senator, so she uses this room. So the next question here. Yeah,
This follows on from Renee's question. And there was a recent poll conducted in the United States that came out in April 2009 that showed that 14% less of the American public saw any solid evidence of global warming. What are we doing that we're not getting this across to the public? Why are we failing? It's very much what Renee said. Why are we failing in our ability to get our ideas and to get this knowledge across to people that there is actually a problem right now?
It's because there is a very well-funded, concerted effort by energy companies to confuse the public and hire charlatan scientists to confuse them and say that it's not real, and they spend lots of money on television advertising.
Oh, yeah.
And
CO2 is necessary for life.
Yeah, and so it's we're not organized to inform the public. We're organized to do science, and they're organized. They spend millions of dollars to confuse people so that they can make more money. And they did that. They said smoking was safe. It's the same companies that actually were doing the propaganda that tried to convince people that smoking was safe. You know, doctors recommend Camels. And so it's just complete dishonesty and trying to confuse people, and they're successful at it.
How can we get the press on our side? Is there this reduction in the number of people seeing solid evidence of global warming in 1 year? Is it because the press has been emphasizing the economy rather than the environment?
Well, part of it is I'm not sure. It makes a big difference exactly how you ask the question, so I'm not sure exactly what question they were responding to. But the press is a problem because in journalism school you're taught to have a balanced point of view, so they want to have one side and the other side. Even if one side has no validity, they find one or two people who are willing to criticize climate change, and people get confused. They think if they are actually given a forum that their views are equally valid with everybody else. And so that's part of the problem too, is that the press does not do a good job in informing people about the science. But that's not that everybody agrees on global warming doesn't sell newspapers. That's part of the problem too.
Mm-hmm. John?
I think there's another important aspect to this as well, and that is that, like Alan has pointed out, global climate change is manifested very differently throughout the globe. In fact, most of the observed temperature rises have been occurring at latitudes well away from where the American public sits. So the actual temperature changes that have been occurring have been relatively far removed physically from the continental United States. And that, because of the way people think, particularly in the United States, forces people to believe that nothing really is happening. There is a distinct lack of a global view here.
Yeah, but there is also the increase in extreme weather conditions, like extreme hurricanes, extreme typhoons. Now, this does impact the U.S., and this was a poll conducted specifically in the U.S.
But we can't honestly say that Hurricane Katrina was caused by global warming. We can just talk in statistical terms that the frequency of these events will increase, but specific events can't be tied to it.
You know, I didn't think the frequency had increased as much as the intensity.
Okay, or the intensity. The same time that Jim and I were in Congress, that at noon, when our hearing ended, Pat Michaels from the Cato Institute, former state climatologist of Virginia, who was fired as state climatologist, now works for the Cato Institute, was having a briefing on Capitol Hill with free food for all the staffers to point out that global warming was completely wrong. That's just an example of how insidious it is and how they spend money on these people who will honestly give misinformation in exchange for being paid for it. So they're very, we don't have time to keep up with that. I mean, it's not, whose job is it to counteract that? Al Gore has started this organization with where they have television advertisements now about global warming, and he has a new book out. He's been doing the talk show. He was on Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert the same night, so he is collecting money and advertising and trying to counteract that, and they have television ads, they have print ads, and so, but it's, people get confused when they hear different people say different things. So that means the deniers are successful.
Okay, Chris?
Yes. I think that there's a counter hypothesis then that the right wing did it. First of all, the same sort of thing happened in Britain. Second of all, with regard to the U.S., it was two different polls by the Pew, one around January, February, and one this fall, so it wasn't that. Big fall took place. Now, a counter-hypothesis, and I'm not suggesting it is the right one, but I certainly do not think it's a hypothesis put forth by Alan, but a counter one, where the British one may fit better, quite well, is that you've had this rising crescendo of people saying that if at Copenhagen we don't agree, the world sort of comes to an end. Climate is this thing. Now, what happens when you tell people that there's going to be catastrophe? Well, there's a certain, like a cognitive dissonance. It's sort of very much tight like what happens. Take a person who lives in Pennsylvania. Move him to California. Find out before he goes to California what he thinks the chances of a big earthquake is in California. Then ask him after he's settled in California what it is.
There also is this cycle of issue attention, and I think that attention to global warming might have peaked with Gore's movie and his Academy Award. Kerry Emanuel was very out in public about increasing frequency of storms, and Katrina was about that same time. But since then, the Atlantic's been a little quiet, planets cooled off a little bit. And people are scrambling about whether skin surface temperature of the planet is the actual climate system, or whether it's ocean and the gyres and the interactions of the interdecadal plus oscillations. So you've seen a movement in discussion amongst the educated earth science type people away from skin temperature into earth systems interacting, including the upper lithosphere and the oceans, especially in the ice sheets. And so I think that I had an old chart. It showed climate discourse plotted against climate temperatures, and there was a confusing discourse going on in the 70s when the Earth had apparently cooled off according to records. And then there was a strong warming. The issue of attention peaked again when Jim Hansen spoke before Congress, and the 1988 front page of the New York Times: global warming has begun. That was the day I moved to Maine, and I bought a New York Times, and I said to my wife, look, we're headed up north from Washington. And there was a widest acceptance that the Yellowstone fires and all that was going on was visual evidence. And so we've gone through a couple of those cycles. There's a guy he used to be with the Office of Technology Assessment. He's now with the National Academies, and he's actually plotted congressional and news attention in cycles as they come and go. And it's very interesting, but right now I think we're in a down cycle. And we've had, this coldest October on record in the U.S., but not globally. And so people in the U.S. will focus on frost on the pumpkin and use it as a reason not to accept the what the scientists are saying. But I think we're just in a down cycle right now.
Okay, there's a question right in the back of the room.
Thanks, Nigel. The last time I looked, Sweden is a developed country, not a developing country. They've enacted cap and trade. They are one of the great industrial empires, along with Germany, servicing China now. You know, they built the Nest, which is an engineering marvel. They produced the best hockey players, the best steel. Now, in Canada, Stefan Dionne ran. I was at the convention there, and he ran, and he won by a whisker because he was a greening, the man of the greening of America. And, of course, when he got into he was a opposition, in the opposition, leading the opposition, of course, they threw him out. The industrial complex just knocked him down. Obama, he couldn't even start to enact cap and trade. Obama's trying to mention it now. You know, he's going to knock him out of power by the year 2012. I mean, in North America, I'm not saying socialism is better, but Sweden has done a hell of a job in showing the example. But you guys mention China all the time and looking for other reasons. Why don't you use Sweden as an example?
I'll take issue with the hockey player, but the rest of the question is valid.
Thanks.
So, anybody of our panelists want to take that?
Well, there's a total difference. Sweden.
Use
well,
the mic.
Sweden is a small, relatively homogeneous, developed country, which has a lot of hydro. It also has a lot of wood. Some of the wood it actually gets from apparently across the Baltic and ships it in. Therefore, it isn't counted in their emissions. It's a very, very different type of situation. China is a country that has 1.3 billion people. I think Sweden, about 8 billion? It could be 8 million. 1.3 billion in the case of million. It's a totally different, you can't compare it. One is a developing country where it started at least in 1978 at very, very low levels. It has to restructure itself totally. Sweden has a very slow growing population. It doesn't have to build up. Its population per land area is very modest. So I just think that using Sweden as an example here, to sort of use that as a way to understand what is happening in the world. Let me just make one thing. There's not just a revolution here so far as climate is concerned. There's a revolution, a transformation of much of the world's economy. When I was the age of the students here or younger, it looked like it would be impossible that much of the world, even by the time I got very old at my age today, there would, more than a handful of people were going to be of the developing world or the poor world would be much better. Something has fundamentally changed, particularly in Asia. And that change, that transformation, involves all sorts of things, but it also uses energy. And particularly because you're dealing with large populations on relatively small areas, you're going to have to use, in the initial stages, the materials that are going to be very energy intensive. So it's, I just don't think starting from this Sweden or Denmark are good examples of what is really happening in much of the world today. That's the best I can say in answering to you. I just can't see any analogy.
Okay, we have a question here in the back row.
Okay, thanks. I know most of you will know more about the stats on this than me, but why do we compare country to country? We should be comparing per capita to per capita. And China has some of the lowest CO2 emissions per capita around the world. And if we want a model, we should be using China. They're using about 100% of their natural gas. You can go to villages in China that don't have a paved road that now have hot water in some houses because they have a solar panel to make hot water. They, after harvesting rice and soybeans, they cut the stems and use that for cooking fuel in the villages of Jingzhou province anyway. They're doing everything they can to reduce their CO2 emissions, but they have... China and India both would are growing in population by the population of Canada every year or something crazy like that. But they are not being wasteful, unless they take you out to dinner. That's about the only time.
Is there a question?
Yes. So the point is what should we be using? Should we be comparing country to country? Why don't we consider this per capita? And if we consider it per capita, what is the appropriate model to use?
Any response?
Well, I think that per capita is important, at least to making some comparisons, but it's not always a perfectly good measure. I mean, there are a lot of other factors that go into this, but at least given the sorts of comparison between Sweden and China, that certainly is. China has low emissions, although they're rising fast now. They're still much, much lower, let's say a quarter of those or a fifth of those in the U.S. and probably a third of those in Sweden. And India has much lower per capita emissions. And you're going to see a revolution taking place in India. Look, you know, I don't see if you think of the problem in this way, if ultimately it's what we're the stock of carbon in the atmosphere, much of that is affected by our using of fossil fuels. So you're concerned about emissions, but turn it over to the drivers. Three, I indicated before, there are four drivers, two of which can be put together. One is population, one is output per capita. Of course, you could do that as, of course, that's very close to what you just were referring to, only you want emissions per capita. And then there is energy intensity, and that will depend very much on a lot of factors in the development process and the type of, so we are a much more energy intensive country than the United States.
Okay, I have three.
And then there is low carbon energies. So unless you focus on those latter two technology ones, you cannot stabilize climate. And those people who think that we can stabilize climate with just the existing technologies, without having new technologies to allow the existing ones to scale up, I think are just, they're bringing about geoengineering. I think the biggest reason why geoengineering has become very interesting is because we've focused so much on emissions and not on the technological drivers. And we're wasted since 1992, then since 1997. And look, if Copenhagen is the same thing as Kyoto, we're going to waste another decade.
Okay, so I've got three questions here. We will try to get through them. Some of our guests do have to make it to the airport. To return, so we're on tight leash. So, this gentleman here.
I was wondering, because of the rapid changes that are happening right now in poorer global South countries, and the rapid decrease of their wealth and their actual well-being, how can mitigation help? Considering that nothing as much has been done recently in the last decade or so. How can mitigation actually help those people who are being hurt the most right now by climate change?
I think I've monopolized already this last bit. Are you asking
me? It's anyone who wants to answer.
I think going back to your question on mitigation, I don't think it has been exhaustively studied in the sense that the same way. I'm taking an example from nuclear waste management, which I'm familiar with. The technology is there. The possibilities are enormous for waste management as well. But trying to convince the public that these are feasible solutions has always been the biggest obstacle. And until you get this concept cleared up, you will not be able to get even mitigation as a feasible one. It's a public perception that some things will not work, and mitigation is currently suffering from that.
Okay.
I think there's a great opportunity to develop technologies that can help the developing world increase their standard of living by utilizing solar power and wind power, developing technologies that can be put onto a house or into a village that can provide them with a source of energy that they just didn't have before, especially if you can work on storage technologies. And so some of the technologies that will work on a distributed scale in the developed world that will be developed here can be distributed around the world without them having to continue to burn the forests and use charcoal or use fossil fuels. It's a real opportunity to do that.
Okay. Next question was from here.
So European sociologist Ulrich Beck has come up with this, well, he's written about the idea that we're currently in the state of being a risk society where we've gotten to the point where we've developed technologies and things like nuclear where there's no way to simply put these things into a box and test them without essentially testing them on ourselves. As he puts it, we're basically the test tube baby. Now, I appreciated David Keith's points last night nuancing his putting forth geoengineering as a solution. But I'm just wondering what the panelists think about how to proceed with developing geoengineering technologies ethically. How can we develop these when we simply can't test them without testing them on ourselves, and there simply are no international protocols or sort of organizations to manage these?
That's for the panelists, Alan or Phil, I think would take that.
Well, my response is I don't know the answer. What I do know is that we are so far away from being interested in attempting to test any geoengineering technology on a large scale that I'm willing to try to work out the decision as we go along. And I feel we're still in the baby steps of considering whether there are any viable technologies. I'm concerned also that just because at this point the issue is on the table, that at some point single country or independent country might decide that they're going to take things into their own hands and try a geoengineering experiment without the research having been done before to see whether there to try and assess what the pitfalls are. In the end, it will be an experiment on ourselves, and there will be risks involved. And that's why everybody who thinks about geoengineering suggests that it be used only as a last resort, and only if one's absolutely convinced that we're in a planetary emergency and that what we are trying to do is stave off that emergency for a few decades while we find a solution, a better solution, like drawing down CO2 concentrations.
Okay, one very last short question.
I'm sorry that this can't be that short. As someone who has given that there's a lack of current carbon-free transportation fuel or cheap scalable electricity fuel, would you be at all, I mean, we can talk, but I like action. So would you advocate at all for a strong international economic policy such as a carbon tax going towards research and development and adaptation? Or, this is fairly unconventional, but as I see it, a focus in the scientific community really talking about the world population growth, slowing growth, reducing growth, because I see this very much so as a population problem. We're going to be consuming energy. We don't do it carbon-free. Population's a big problem.
Based on my own personal values, yes, I would advocate a global carbon tax. But the country with the strongest population policy is the one that's increasing CO2 emissions the most. So it's not the number of people, it's the emissions per person. If the number of people doesn't go up very much, but emissions per person goes way up, like in China, population isn't going to help you. Control isn't going to help you. So, and as you know, when countries become more developed, the population stops going up as fast. So I don't know how you can force individuals to make decisions that you want them to make about having children except the way they do it in China. I'm not sure that would go over too well in the rest of the world.
Okay. Well, on that note, we have hit the 2:30 mark. I would like to thank the panelists, the discussants that participated today, and I'd like to extend a particular thanks to our three remaining panelists, Phil Raich, Alan Robach, and James Fleming, for coming to McGill for the last 2 days and helping us gain some insight to this problem, which I am sure we're going to hear more about rather than less in the future. And I think that the McGill crowd and the McGill community is much more enlightened now about the issues than we were 24 hours ago. So I thank you for your visit and your participation on behalf of Lauren Tarace, who's sponsored the last couple of days, the Dean of Science, and the McGill community. Thank you very much. And there are goodies outside that people are welcome to mingle.
You have time to come up here.